ready for this?
I'm just studying our panelists and their body language as this is playing. As you listen to this, does it make you feel more powerful? This song is a prime example of songs that do, according to researchers at Northwestern University in Illinois, especially if the bass is strong. Does that seem right to you? There are certain songs, and this is one of them, that make you feel more powerful, gentlemen. Hang on, I'll turn, you'll be more powerful with your microphone.
Yeah, that really showed a little bit. I was going to say, I am a husband, a father of a teenager, and a school teacher. I have not felt powerful in years. It's going to take more than music to do it for me.
Very good, okay. You are now more willing, theoretically, to work hard or to exercise, for example, after hearing this. So when you see the athletes come into the stadium, you know, looking grim on the bus with their headphones on, they're listening to music like this, then it's going to work for them.
Well, not necessarily. I think with different sports, we need different types of music. I mean, obviously sports just involve a lot of, very vigorous activity. Say rugby is probably quite different to someone who's just about to, compete in the darts champs, where keeping, your mind calm and focused is probably better. So probably
you mean what,
Kenny Rogers might be a better pick there.
It's a good point.
But I've also found, the songs that are in the study, they're very physical activity type songs. I mean,
yeah.
I don't do it as much because I'm a bit more organised with my work habits. But when I used to work for magazines and had weekly deadlines, and I'd do all the work in the night before it was due, so I needed to be able to focus for 8 or 9 hours. I wouldn't pick that stuff. Instead, I listened to a lot of heavy metal, particularly Tool, which I found very good at sort of putting me in a zone. But I think it was just more personal preference rather than sort of beat.
Putting you in a zone, or could you work with the heavy metal on as well?
Oh, absolutely. Well,
you could.
Yeah, I could. My productivity was amazing.
Really?
Yeah.
Because they say that, and this is actually different research, but it's reported in the Huffington Post, they say that ambient noise, as opposed to what you were listening to, improves creativity. Something bland is playing.
This is the part of the writing process where it's not creative. Well, it's a wee bit of creativity, but you've got all your notes there. You just need to hammer down the words. Mm. You just want something with a good beat, so you're just tapping away for hours on end. And that's quite different to the stage where you're sort of brainstorming.
When you're actually sitting there reading and trying to to intake and process, you can't have anything. I can't have anything playing then. But obviously, I think it's a different lower plane from you.
From Harriet Watt University, wherever that is.
Edinburgh.
Thank you. Heavy metal fans, I was just searching for heavy metal because they go through all the genres. Heavy metal fans.
Low self-esteem.
Low self-esteem. Not hardworking. Not outgoing.
Well,
as opposed to...
2 out of 3 there.
got you in a nutshell there, haven't they, mate? Yeah.
As opposed to country and western fans, hardworking and outgoing. Classical music fans, high self-esteem, creative, introverted, at ease.
When I started reading through this list, I thought it was a load of crock because it started off that all the descriptors were positive, blues, high self-esteem, creative. But then I got back to good old hipsters in indie, which was low self-esteem, creative, but slackers, not hardworking, and they're not gentle. So, I mean, that's the worst.
But it
does confirm many prejudices I hold about guys with goatees.
But it also implies that you're only allowed to like one kind of music. Because I like my rock and my heavy metal, but I'm also, obviously a broad spectrum. I love a bit of blues as well. So when I listen to rock and heavy metal, apparently I have low self-esteem. But as soon as I switch over and put some Eric Clapton on, then suddenly I have high self-esteem. How does that work? Does it imply that you're only allowed to like one kind of music? It's very one-dimensional.
Eric Clapton can change your life.
Well, absolutely. Yes.
Judiciously applied.
Yes.
In your ears. People saying in New Zealand, there is, and this is what I thought, by law, a quite small limit to the amount of coin which can be included in a legal tender payment, says Ross Conland. And Martin of Auckland says the old rule had limits based on which coins were used, between $10 up to $100, although no limits, he doesn't think, were ever gazetted for gold coins. And no limits for notes.
I think the limit should be weight-based. If you're paying in more than a kilo of coins, you should be ejected from any premises.
Yeah. And just for the record, people are welcome to give me as many gold coins as they like. I will impose no limits.
It's very generous of you.
It's the kind of guy I am.
And would you be generous with your thoughts, too, at 20 minutes to 5? What would you like to mention?
Well, I would like to mention, basically, this is something I've touched about, actually, before when I've been here, but I'd like to have give full rein to my thoughts, because I've been thinking lately about how I can do my job better. You know, there's this whole part of being a teacher, and we spend a lot of our time trying to figure out how we can enhance student achievement. It's that time of the year when we're getting a lot of pressure from our middle and senior management at school, from Eero, from the ministry, trying to get to make sure that we get as many kids through their NCA assessments as possible. The pressure is always on, what can we do more? And we do everything we can. For all the joking that we do about looking forward to the holidays and all the rest, we are professionals and we work hard. But it occurred to me, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, when we had a parents' evening at my school, that much of what I'm doing is almost entirely futile. When I teach 46 year 10 students this year, I have 46 over two classes. We had a parents' evening, I saw 46 students, I saw two parents. Which means that of 46, 44 parents, 44 pairs of parents, either couldn't or chose not to attend a parents' evening to get involved with their kids' education. We do everything in our power at school to work with the kids and then to invite their parents into school, to engage with them. We want to make sure that they know what's going on. And so what the message is coming back to us is very clear, that no matter what we do, our children go home and everything that they've done in school during the day is not being reinforced, is not being valued, is not being endorsed at home. And we only see them for a few hours a day. These are the parents who brought them up from infancy. These are the ones who've got the real influence. And I'm going to do something I very, very rarely do here. I'm actually going to cite John Hattie, who will back me up on this, whose research points to the fact that the single biggest influence in a child's attitudes to life in general are going to be the parents. And so in the classroom, it's not what we're doing. It's what the parents are reinforcing that matters. And when I've got two out of 46 parents who actually show up to a parents' evening, if my school fails, or if my kids fail, or if I'm not getting the results necessary, don't tell the teachers it's our fault. We're doing everything in our power. If parents aren't reinforcing and endorsing what we do, then it's for naught.
Was this two-parent turnout reflected over the other classrooms that evening or those evenings?
No, oddly enough, I'm glad you asked that one. I do have a Year 9 class this year as well. Now, my Year 9 class is the High Achievers class. A third of the parents showed up.
Just a third. And based on Hattie's research, that would indicate that those parents are probably more involved at home.
Precisely.
But only a third.
But even then, to be fair, that's pretty bad that even within what we consider to be our academic, our high-achieving class, we only got a third. But if you're going to get anyone showing up, it's going to be the parents of the high-achieving kids. Generally speaking, there seems to be a very, very close correlation between, on the one hand, parent non-engagement, and on the other hand, low achievement, high truancy, poor discipline, low literacy. There's a very, very clear relationship, and it's not just in my school. And so when you start seeing Metro magazine pulling out their little analysis of the best and the worst schools in Auckland, and I see my school not at the top, I'm starting to think there is something else going on. And it's not a decile thing. I know my school is a very low decile school, but Macaulay, which is a decile one, routinely gets called out as being one of the best schools in the entire of Auckland. And from what I've heard of people who work there, they tell me it's because there is enormous parental engagement.
Okay, so what's the difference? What is the difference?
I can't point to why the parents aren't engaged. I can't answer that one. I know that they appear not to be.
All right. Okay, without going into a two-school comparison, but that must cause despondency in the classroom. Staff room.
Just a little bit, yes. Yeah. Especially when the achievement numbers are used as a stick to beat us with by Eero and by the ministry, who don't really understand there's that dimension. We're doing everything in our power to get parents in. We send postcards out, we make phone calls, text messages, emails.
What about bribery? I mean, could you offer a discount on school fees, for instance?
We don't charge school fees.
Oh, well, there you go. Maybe you should charge them and then offer a discount. Like, you don't have to pay them if you show up at the damn meeting.
Yeah, possibly.
You're getting a lot of reaction on this. I teach in a decile 10 school and saw every parent of every pupil. And someone says, touche, regarding parents and teachers. And someone else says, obviously has the same experience as you, and someone else says, I'm a secondary teacher in a low decile school. I have classes where no parents turn up for interviews and do not respond to my efforts to contact them. So it's different experiences in different schools. All right. That was interesting. Steve McCabe. Matt Nippert, what's on your mind?
Well, given the election's coming up, this is a bugbear of mine that's been, well, it's been growling away for the last 6 or so months, regarding the topic of coattailing and these electoral deals. It seems to dominate the political discourse because I guess it's a nice focus story we can talk about, like who's, well, you know, are ACT going to get in, are National going to gift them, and then, of course, the tie-up between Internet and Mana. And I think most people think these sort of deals are abhorrent. I mean, it involves people voting for someone they don't agree with. And it feels like the system is being corrupted. I'd just like to say that, and this is to appropriate a hip-hop term, I hate the game, not the player, that I think we should hate our electoral system, not our elected representatives. I think the real problem here isn't MMP, it isn't venal, calculating Machiavellian politicians, because they're working within the system they have to maximise their share of Parliament. It's rather this 5% MMP threshold, I think, is creating the problem. The root of the issue is that because of that threshold, there's a lot of wasted votes. And it's ridiculous to have wasted votes, but if you can somehow gerrymander an electorate, you can turn all those sub-5% parties, the votes count. Mm. I think we should just scrap the 5% threshold. Every vote would count. There'd be no need for these sort of deals. And it would seem to be a lot more straightforward. Sure, we'd get a couple of joke candidates in, but given the last couple of terms, which we've had the likes of David Garrett and John Banks and Brendan Horan and Aaron Gilmore, I don't think we'd get any more or less comedians than previously.
And Hickey Aparato?
And Hickey. Well, goodness me.
Did I say that out loud? Sorry.
This is the representation versus stability argument, isn't it? It'd be far better representation would you have as stable a government. And you're actually saying, well, look at the one we've got, aren't you?
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm also saying that the same argument about stability was brought up when we had MMP brought in. Remember those guys sort of campaigning for FPP, and they had all the ads with the brown paper bags, and they're saying, oh, it'll be the end, we'll be just like Italy, and we'll have, you know, a dozen governments in a year. And it's actually been really stable, hasn't it? And there was that one time where Winston walked down, it sort of looked a bit wobbly, and then the alliance fell over, but the elections have been every 3 years. There hasn't been any major crisis. Only a couple of laws haven't passed, and they're pretty minor, but confidence and supply has been enjoyed the whole way through. I mean, sure, we'd get more parties in Parliament, but if you've got people voting for them, they deserve a constituency. I don't personally agree with Winston Peters, but if he gets a couple of 100,000 people voting for him, I don't think we should deny him a voice in Parliament.
Would it work well enough lowering the threshold, not just to 4, as has been suggested, but to, I don't know, 3, 2, whatever?
Are you just saying abolish the threshold entirely? Lower the better. So effectively, if you wiped it, it would effectively be 0.8%, because that would be the split between 120 MPs. I mean, I don't think this will happen. It's a policy that would really disadvantage the entrenched parties, particularly Labour and National, and they're the ones with the numbers to the only one to the numbers to pass this. But I've often called out when we get discussions about dirty deals and the like on Twitter, you know, will no one rid me of this turbulent 5% threshold? And I do hope that some others, perhaps in a position of power, will take me up on this crusade. I think we'll get a much more representative democracy and finally abolish all these talks of coattailing and deals. And it will just be a simple contest of who gets the most votes.
Matt Nippert, thank you. 12 minutes to 5. Here's a typical email among many from listeners on the subject of Stephen Dudley's very sad death and the treatment of his attackers by the court. And this is milder than some, as you can imagine. This is from Elmer Ray. Stephen's undiagnosed heart condition may well have led to an early demise, but on that particular afternoon, I'm quite sure Stephen would have arrived home alive if he hadn't been set on. I'm okay with the sentencing, but I still don't understand the logic preceding it. And of course, she's not alone. Professor Mark Hanahan's going to join us in a tick. What was your reaction yesterday to the verdict of the court, just before we discuss particular points of this with Mark?
After you, mate.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a tragic case. I mean, no one wants to see their son die. But it seems a very, very unusual case in that, these attackers were only charged with assault. It wasn't grievous bodily harm. It wasn't assault to intend to injure. It didn't seem as though there was, you know, while he was left unconscious, it hasn't been made clear whether that was because he was, you know, punched in the head so hard he fell unconscious, or this heart issue popped up. And while your listener's probably correct that he may have come home that day if he hadn't been hadn't been punched. If the next time he saw a horror movie, the same outcome could have happened. And I don't think we'd be blaming the horror movie for murder if that happened.
I mean, we're looking at the report that we've got to work from here, and it does say that the Crown withdrew the manslaughter charge after receiving two expert reports. It says that the heart condition contributed to his death.
Yes, we went through this yesterday.
Which is fair, but let's face it, so did the punch. And the punch was...
Well, we don't know that.
Well...
That couldn't be established.
Okay, I'll accept that it couldn't be established to a legal degree of certainty. However, let's face it, I think it's fair to say there is a greater chance of him dying from aggravations of an underlying heart condition if he has been punched than if he hasn't. And yes, certainly, I mean, obviously murder charge would have been completely inappropriate. I would have thought manslaughter would have been reasonable because the kind of punch that would have laid him low presumably could have done severe damage and was inflicted with reckless disregard.
Yes, but there was no question of a manslaughter conviction, but people are asking about an assault conviction, which Matt began to mention then.
Yeah, and even that's bizarre.
Let's talk to Mark. Professor Mark Hennehan is kindly joining us, Dean of Law at Otago. Good evening, Mark.
Good evening, Jim.
There are interesting points, and perhaps you can assist us with a few of them. The idea that a predisposing medical condition absolves your attacker of manslaughter, which is what Steve is mentioning, when you may well have walked home quite happily from rugby practice if you hadn't been assaulted. There must be precedent cases here, preceding legal doctrine?
Yeah, I think the key thing is the law requires the act to be the operative cause, or the kind of, it doesn't have to be the only cause, but the operative cause. And obviously they've weighed it up very carefully with the medical experts, said, well, while the boy punched him, that wasn't the kind of main or operative cause as to why he died. It was the pre-existing medical condition. Now, that's a clinical decision that's obviously been made. The Crown have listened to it carefully and thought, if we go to trial on this, we really haven't got sufficient evidence to say that was the primary or operative cause as to why this young boy died.
Okay. There is the notion cited by the judge that being under 19 and not having a fully formed brain was presumably influential on not being convicted of an assault. Are psychologists now changing the age of criminal liability? Because he's an adult in terms of which court he has to appear in, he can fight in the war, he can drink in a pub, Mark.
No, I think what the judge did with that was he pleaded guilty to assault with intent to injure. So that's been accepted. The question then was, do we give him conviction with discharge, or do we uphold the conviction and give him community sentence? And I think what the judge did here was say, well, the assault, and this is where the real issue is, because all she had to go on was the assault, not the death. And was this a sufficiently serious assault that there should be some deterrent, there should be some punishment for it? On the other hand, she has to weigh up, if we do give him a conviction, will that be a disproportion in terms of his future career and all those other things, in terms of the consequences for him? She classified the judge, Justice Wilhelm, and said the assault here was kind of moderate. It wasn't. There was no lasting injury, I mean, in terms of on his body, didn't break a rib or break a jaw and those sorts of things. So while it was an assault, she classified it, and the defence did, and the Crown disagreed with that, but classified it as being, the judge classified it as being in the moderate area. So she has to take that into account and then say, well, is it disproportionate to give him a conviction for what I would classify as a moderate assault? She classified it like a normal schoolyard kind of fight, and then say he's going to have this assault with intent to injure on his record, which will impinge on his future career, impinge on his job prospects, and maybe impinge on being a fully functioning citizen in our society. And that's what she has to weigh up. And she came down on the basis that it would be disproportionate to put the conviction on.
Yeah. So there was no unassailable fact that he died because of the attack somehow.
No.
That could not be established.
And if that had been established, we would have had quite a different outcome, because manslaughter is a very serious charge, and you wouldn't get a conviction discharge for that, I think, if that had been the cause. I think that was the crucial fact here. And it's mentioned several times by Justice Helen Wynne-Calman in her judgment that I have to make it clear, I'm not... this is not about the death, it's about the assault, and that's all I can go on, because it's been found by the Crown and by the medical experts that the causation wasn't of death, was not the assault in this case.
Can I ask you, before I give you another case, can I ask you about, there's been a lot of criticism by some quite prominent media journalists of this decision. To what extent is that allowed now, open slather, as it were, on what judges decide?
Oh, I think one of the great things about our system, it's crucial, is open justice. And I think the media and citizens are entitled to have their point of view. We live in a democratic society, and I think judges have to, it's part of the territory for judges, and it's part of the feedback from the community. It shouldn't deter them from applying the law, and I think Justice Helen-Wynne-Calman applied the law very clearly and very openly in this particular case. We'll all have different points of view, and there's nothing in our law that says you cannot criticise judgments, as long as I think people have read the whole judgment and understood the whole facts, but criticism,
which probably rarely happens, actually.
Which normally does happen, unfortunately. Yeah, I think good criticism is but judges just have to take that criticism, and they're not meant to respond, and that's part of being a public functionary. It's part of the territory of being a judge. People will disagree with you, and sometimes the media will take you to task. And I think it's good we have these discussions to try and get a balanced view of, you know, where do we think the judge stands. These things have to be debated openly in our society. So there's nothing wrong with criticising a judgment, no.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that we are allowed to criticise a judgment, because in that case, the judge needs to hear some criticism. Because basically, looking at the facts of this, you've got an adult who has joined in a seemingly, essentially unprovoked attack on a younger boy. Is a 2-on-1, described in this report as a sustained attack. Now, that's got nothing to do with a pre-existing condition. This is a somewhat vicious assault, and the judge has said that because you're a nice boy otherwise, you get quite literally a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yeah, well, I think you've added a couple of terms in there, like vicious assault. The things about the assault, and the judge did take these into account. It was unprovoked, so in other words, the person who died didn't provoke this. It was two people onto one. I agree with that. He was an older boy. He was 17 at the time, and there was a punch to the vulnerable part of the body, the neck, and there were several punches to the stomach afterwards. So all those things were taken into account in assessing the gravity of the particular assault. And the judge, having looked at all those things, thought it was in the moderate range. And I think the main reason for that was if the boy didn't have the heart condition, there would have been no injuries afterwards. Because assault with intent to injure, if you've got injuries, broken jaw, broken ribs, then obviously it goes up a notch. So none of those things actually occurred in this particular case.
So to paraphrase, an unprovoked 2-on-1 sustained assault doesn't attract a conviction if it's moderate.
No, I don't. Well, the argument here was it classified in the moderate range, and then you have to weigh up, if we do put a conviction up to this, will the punishment be disproportionate given it was a moderate assault and classified as that by the judge having heard all the evidence? Will this going on? Because once it goes on your record, it's on your record for a long time, assault with intent to injure. Will that in itself have consequences that are out of proportion?
Can I ask you more about that? And in the time we've got left, just mention another case, because the media have picked up on an assault in a club in Auckland, Cassette 9, and they've picked up on it because the victim ended up going to jail and the attacker did not. But the victim went to jail because he was found to be an overstayer, so that needn't concern us beyond observing the novelty of it. But this chap was king hit. He suffered life-threatening injuries. He was knocked unconscious on the dance floor. The perpetrator had been convicted, Mark, of two previous assaults, against police. And the police wanted jail. But the judge took into account the defendant's stable employment, among other things, and how that would be jeopardised. Now, we weren't there, and we didn't, as is always said, we don't know all the facts of the case. The guy may have had stable employment, but he had a very unstable record of violence. Is there a kind of flight in the judiciary now from regarding prison as necessarily punitive? Are circumstances too personalised now?
Well, I think one can always look at isolated cases, and I haven't got a copy of the judgment. I've read the actual report from the media, which does say that basically there was an emphasis on him being working hard and stable employment, and the sense was, I suppose, he was sentenced to intense supervision, so he's not going to have total freedom to roam. And I suppose you've got to weigh up, to what degree do we be punitive, because jail is really a punitive element, and to what degree do we say, look, at the end of the day, this chap's made some progress, so we want to keep him on track. We put him in jail, as there's a lot of evidence to say spending time in jail can put people backwards as they get into bad habits, get into bad elements, and come out far worse for all of us. So we've got to weigh up as a society, to what degree do we punish, and punishment is important to some degree, and to what degree do we want these people to be productive members of our society, and they're really important issues, and I think jail has never made people productive members of society, and people become kind of worse off often. That doesn't mean we shouldn't punish people, but in this case, there was some punishment, intense supervision, and people might say that's not enough, but I think he's trying to weigh up the two things, the judge in this case.
That's interesting. He said himself he had trouble deciding.
Yes.
Professor Mark Hennahan, thank you, and have a good weekend. And the same applies to you, Matt Nippert. Thank you for being on with us today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, Jim.
Is your boy happy at Kindy?
Oh, he loves it. It's great because he comes home tired and actually goes to bed by 8:30 now.
Oh, isn't that a blessing? Steve McCabe, thanks for being on the panel, you two.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, everybody. Have a lovely weekend if you're leaving us now. Otherwise, Checkpoint follows.